Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, December 16th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Ninth Circuit Court hears arguments in Idaho's complete abortion ban law and whether it violates federal law regarding emergency care for pregnant women who might die or have their health permanently impacted. Southwestern Idaho National Organization for Women chapter holds protests in Boise ahead of legislative session. Joe Biden sends $6.1 billion out the door for Idaho-based Micron and a $500,000 settlement in Spokane police killing. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. An 11-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments last week on Idaho's trigger abortion law, which makes it a felony to perform an abortion during an entire pregnancy, with the exception to save the life of the mother, or rape or incest with a police report. The U.S. Justice Department sued Idaho in 2022 after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, saying the law violates the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, also known as EMTALA, which requires Medicare-funded hospitals to treat patients in emergency rooms regardless of their ability to pay. Doctors say they need more clarity in the law because they can't assess when to safely intervene to save someone's life. For example, sepsis is a complication of pregnancy that can occur without clearing the uterus, but it is sometimes but not always fatal. The Supreme Court heard the case but kicked it back to the Ninth Circuit Court in June. That put the Ninth Circuit Court's stay on enforcing Idaho's law back in place. The CNN cable news network said multiple judges on the panel brought up whether the new Trump administration would drop the Justice Department case, presumably because the Trump administration has politically taken positions hostile towards women's health in the past. The CNN cable news network reported several appeals court judges indicated they might be more inclined to leave the stay in place and return the case to the trial court for arguments on its merits. An attorney for Idaho's largest hospital system, St. Luke's, told the court his hospital might sue to keep the case alive if the Trump administration drops the suit. Emergency doctors have airlifted pregnant patients out of state before their complications became life-threatening rather than take the chance of violating Idaho's felony abortion law, which carries sentences of up to 5 years in prison. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted a Ninth Circuit Court injunction against enforcing Idaho's ban in January. And in the 4 months after that, St. Luke's had airlifted six pregnant patients out of state. Attorneys representing the Idaho legislature say the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act also requires emergency room doctors to provide stabilizing treatment to an unborn child, actually a fetus. They also claim that abortions as stabilizing treatment, as described by doctors, would fall under Idaho's exception to save the life of the pregnant person. According to the news outlet Stateline, the attorneys representing the Idaho legislature, one of them being Taylor Meehan, told Ninth Circuit judges, "It's not a statute about emergency care. It's a statute that primarily prohibits elective criminal abortions. It's not about medical treatment." Here's Meehan in exchanges with the appeals judges on the panel.
It's the burden of the physician to show he was acting in good faith rather than the burden of the state to show beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't have good faith. What do we do with that?
I think that might have been true at the time of Judge Windmill's decision when the statute was still phrased as affirmative defenses. But now that the statute's exceptions, I think that that falls out of the case. And
so you don't think the burden is on the physician to save his or her career and possibly avoid some jail time?
No, if anything, the burden's on the prosecutor, who's as bound by the Idaho Supreme Court decision to decide to bring charges against a physician.
But how are the doctors supposed to know that if it's not explicit? What's the standard of care here that's being provided that you seem to think that is encompassed within what the Idaho Supreme Court did?
Well, Your Honor, to be clear, the Idaho's Defense of Life Act is a prohibition on criminal abortions. It expressly distinguishes criminal abortions from necessary medical treatment. It's not a statute about emergency care. It's a statute that primarily, you know, it prohibits elective criminal abortions. It's not about medical treatment. And that's why I think the legislature's witnesses' declarations are so important. Dr. French explains at the beginning of his declaration that he doesn't understand. Someone who's created EMTALA procedures in ERs and in Idaho and beyond, he doesn't see abortion as first-line medical treatment in emergency rooms. And the minute
the problem is, you know, I've read the declarations that are provided, and some of the declarations are really concerning, especially for someone who lives in Washington, in eastern Washington specifically, has visited places like Sandpoint and understands that their whole obstetrics department has closed down so that this area, this area in Sandpoint, that's a place that some of us visit all the time, there are no services available for women who, let's say, decide or have a situation where they're bleeding out, and yet the service that would be needed is now gone from this area. What do you do in that circumstance?
Well, a couple of responses, Your Honor. First, I don't think EMTALA is the statute to solve that circumstance. Second, Dr. Reynolds said there's a nationwide shortage of OBs. And third, with respect to EMTALA specifically, if a patient is experiencing catastrophic bleeding, there's no disagreement that Idaho law allows treatment for them.
What if it's not catastrophic, counsel, but it's short of resulting in serious injury to the life of or to the woman? What do we do in that circumstance? Does she have to then rely on hopefully a working vehicle to drive across the border into Spokane, Washington, in order to get services there?
No, Your Honor, and I'd point you to pages 415 of the legislative's ER. I'd point you to pages 417 to 418. I think Dr. French is speaking to exactly the circumstance that you're imagining. And he says when you have uncontrollable bleeding.
Let's not imagine. The declarations substantiate the increase in number of Idahoans crossing the border to services in Washington, for example, which is the very thing that Congress was trying to avoid. They were trying to set a baseline level of care for the country, and this happens to be one of the services that is necessary under certain medical situations.
The legislature's witnesses agree with that. The Idaho Supreme Court agrees with that. The Idaho Supreme Court's decision that you don't delay care, that you don't wait, contrary, for example, to some of the amicus briefs we've seen, until a woman is on death's door, that is the law in Idaho. And again, as the legislature's witness said, if you're requiring that woman to bleed out in the emergency room, that's, in her words, a malpractice situation.
Do you wait until you get to that point?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
But how is that clear to the doctors?
It's clear to the doctor because of the Planned Parenthood decision, and as the Supreme Court's decision in RIV makes clear, that authoritative statement on Idaho law is binding here. There's no conflict in the declarations.
That was Taylor Meehan representing the Idaho State Legislature in exchanges with Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges on an en banc panel. One of the Trump-appointed Ninth Circuit judges, Lawrence Van Dyke, asked attorney Lindsay Harrison, representing St. Luke Health System of Idaho, why they sent these six pregnant patients out of state. Harrison replied five had premature rupture of membranes and another had preeclampsia, which is a dangerous high blood pressure condition. Van Dyke said, "Your argument is if the mother wants to kill the baby, even though it's not necessary, then they have to be airlifted. Is that right?" Those on the extreme right have taken to calling fetuses and embryos babies since the reversal of Roe v. Wade. Harrison replied, "Physicians cannot immediately determine whether a pregnant patient's life is at risk, so if they send a patient to where abortion is legal, the full spectrum of care options would be available." The Ninth Circuit Court will likely issue a decision in the case in a few months. The Southwest Idaho chapter of the National Organization for Women marched in downtown Boise Thursday to send a message to the Idaho legislature, which will convene January 6th, according to the chapter's president, Audrey Numbers. "The impetus is all of our collective frustrations about how our rights have been whittled away the past few years, it's disturbing and alarming. Speaking to the Idaho Press about women's right to abortion that had been in effect for 50 years before the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2022 overturning Roe v. Wade, Numbers said, "When you fought so hard for rights you won and then they're taken away, we want to bring attention to this. The legislature is starting up in January, and this is basically a message. We're upset about what you're doing to us, to women and the LGBTQ community, treating people as if they don't matter, our health doesn't matter, our autonomy doesn't matter. There are some folks here in Idaho who even want to take the vote away from us." You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. President Joe Biden has awarded a $6.1 billion subsidy to the Boise-based Micron Corporation to build new computer chip manufacturing plants in Boise and upstate New York. About $1.5 billion is expected to go to a new microchip manufacturing plant in Boise, and $4.6 billion would go to a planned new Micron plant in Clay, New York, near Syracuse. The Idaho Statesman reports, aside from the subsidies, Micron plans on spending $25 billion on its Boise plant and $100 billion on its New York plant over the next 20 years. Politico reports the Biden administration is trying to get high-tech spending out the door before the second Trump administration takes office. Trump claimed during the campaign that the federal subsidies in the CHIPS and Science Act are the wrong way to boost American manufacturing. Biden signed the bipartisan subsidy law in August 2022, which is an effort to increase semiconductor manufacturing domestically. Micron will also receive $275 million to expand and modernize its manufacturing facility in Manassas, Virginia. The U.S. Commerce Department said it will disperse the funds based on Micron completing milestones for the project, but has not said what those milestones are. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo wrote in a news release, "With this investment in Micron, we are delivering on one of the core objectives of the CHIPS program, onshoring the development and production of the most advanced memory semiconductor technology, which is crucial for safeguarding our leadership on artificial intelligence and protecting our economic and national security."
More than a third of Idaho's jails have failed their inspections. However, there aren't likely to be consequences for their failing grades. The nonprofit newsroom Investigate West has created a database of inspections for Idaho's 35 jails over the past 3 years, showing 14 failed in 2024. But Whitney Bryan with Investigate West notes the inspections are not required, as in many other states. She says the Idaho Sheriff's Association conducts the inspections, and all the jails have voluntarily agreed to them.
There is no state agency that oversees Idaho's jails. There's no mandated inspection of any kind in terms of someone from the state going in and checking on jails' conditions and how detainees in those facilities are doing.
Brian says the jails get a report after the inspection, but it's up to the jails to decide what they want to do with that information. She notes that many of the jails that failed said it wasn't possible to pass because they don't have money for things such as building upgrades or new hires. Brian says lawmakers have reached out since the Investigate West database was published. Jails fail the inspection if they don't pass any of the Idaho Sheriff's Association's 8 standards. Brian says one of the standards is to have at least 2 deputies on duty at all times, but some jails failed because they only had 1 on duty at certain times of day.
That was a very common standard that was failed. In fact, every one that failed either had too many detainees or not enough staff, and some of them faced both of those issues.
Brian adds that 9 jails did not pass the association's recommended standards, although this did not cause them to fail the inspection. She says standards in jails don't just protect the people who are incarcerated.
It's not just a rule being broken. And again, it's not a rule if they don't have to follow it. But these standards are designed to protect the people behind bars and the deputies who are keeping those folks safe.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.
KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.
The holiday season is a difficult time of year for families with children in youth detention centers. Families have limited access to children in prisons. Rashida Robbins has a kid in Green Hill School, a 180-bed facility in Chehalis, Washington. She says families were invited to holiday dinners in early December, but Robbins notes this was long before Christmas, and on that day, she says, there will be a hole in her home that can't be filled.
It's pretty tough, and the lack of access to him during these times makes it even tougher. The thought of him just sitting in a locked room makes it unbearable as a parent. It's really rough.
Governor Jay Inslee has announced a proposal for a new youth facility to address overcrowding, specifically at Green Hill. Organizations including Kids Are Kids and Team Child have criticized the plan, saying it doesn't address the current concerns at Green Hill. Stacy Stanaway says unaddressed issues have been the case for her son, who suffered from behavioral challenges before he was sent to Green Hill. She says that disciplinary action meant she wasn't able to visit for the family holiday earlier in the month.
We can't just isolate people from their family, from their community, and expect things to just go away. And so with my son, the holidays especially are really, really difficult for us because he has younger siblings, he has older siblings.
A spokesperson for Green Hill says because the holiday event involved a high number of visitors, the behavior expectations leading up to the event were no physical aggression and drug use 30 days in advance for safety reasons. Stanaway says much of the healing for her boy will have to happen after he comes back from the youth facility.
It's going to be a phase and a period of time that's going to take years in reality of recovery for my child. I feel that time is paused right now.
Robin says sometimes it feels like kids are never meant to get out of a facility like Green Hill. She implores state leaders to do something.
So I would challenge the people that have the power to make changes to do so and be on the right side of history.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The American Postal Workers Union is pushing back against proposed changes to the Postal Service that they say would slow delivery. Among other things, the proposal aims to cancel afternoon deliveries and pickups for areas that are more than 50 miles from a regional hub. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy says elimination of night pickups could save the post office more than $3 billion a year. Daniel Cortez with the Oregon Postal Workers Union says reducing services does not make sense financially.
To think that eliminating services, reducing standards, basically providing the American people with less reliable service is somehow going to make money. It's nonsense.
This is the most recent in a series of changes included in DeJoy's 10-year Delivering for America plan. The union says DeJoy, who was appointed under President Donald Trump, has already raised prices for stamps while closing post offices around the country, especially in rural communities. Cortez says although rural communities would be hit hardest by this latest proposal, urban centers will also be impacted. He explains that the Postal Service has been shutting down processing centers in the state, making Portland the sole distribution site for all of Oregon. This means more mail delays for everyone, including Portlanders.
If the clerks and the employees in the main plant are processing mail for the rest of the region, that means they're not at that same time processing Portland's mail.
These changes come as first-class mail volume has fallen 30% in a decade, with fierce next-day delivery competition. Although the Postal Service says under the new proposal, most first-class mail will not be impacted, Cortez argues management is already failing to meet its lowered delivery standards from 2021. He says mail never used to sit around.
First-class mail was always moving until it got to where it needed to go, and that's just what everybody understood about the service that we're required to provide to the American people.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Briefing documents in the Spokane City Council's agenda say the fiance of a man Spokane police killed is on track to get a $500,000 settlement in a wrongful death suit. Police shot and killed 41-year-old Robert Bradley at his home in September 2022 when they say he pulled a handgun on police when they were trying to serve a court order involving a dispute with a neighbor. Bradley's family sued last year, saying Robert Bradley was unloading guns and camping gear after a camping trip, and police ambushed him, shooting and killing him within seconds of approaching his van parked at his home in the Hillyard neighborhood. Plaintiffs argue Bradley was hard of hearing and was not given time or sufficient warning that he might be killed. Spokane County Prosecutor Larry Haskell declined to file criminal charges against Police Corporal Chris Johnson and Detective Trevor Walker in March, saying the two fired in self-defense, according to the Spokesman Review. Assistant City Attorney Lyndon Smithson told the City Council Bradley's fiancée, Sarah McLaughlin, has agreed to dismiss her claims against the city and the police department in exchange for the $500,000 settlement.
Low-income Montana residents are getting help accessing legal aid online. In some cases, updates to automated legal forms could help residents facing eviction stay in their homes and also assist people who need help with family law issues. Montana Legal Services Association will use the $275,000 technology assistance grant to overhaul and redesign its most used automated online legal forms. MLSA's Lyndon Howard Murphy says the information from those forms will be integrated into the state's court systems.
We know that not everyone can afford a lawyer, and we also know that navigating the court system on your own can be extremely overwhelming. One of the cornerstones of our work here at MLSA is empowering Montanans with the tools they need to handle their civil legal problems pro se. Pro se means without a lawyer.
MLSA data show there is only one legal aid attorney for every 8,900 Montanans who need civil legal help. Lyndon Howard says upgrading the online forms will help improve those numbers. Ron Flagg with the Washington, D.C.-based Legal Services Corporation, which awarded the grant, says streamlining the online help low-income Montanans can access could be the difference between staying in their home and being evicted.
And if you're living on the edge, that means you're one medical expense, one fender bender away from not being able to pay your rent, and having a legal assistance available in those cases is a game changer.
The Legal Services Corporation funds 130 nonprofit legal aid programs nationwide. I'm Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area, there's a 70% chance of precipitation, 60% chance of precipitation tonight. Rain and snow likely before midnight, then a chance of snow. Snow level 2,600 feet, cloudy, low 31. Total nighttime snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. 80% chance of precipitation tomorrow. A chance of snow before 10 a.m. transitioning to rain in the afternoon. Snow level rising to 4,000 feet in the afternoon. High 37. New snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. 90% chance of rain Tuesday night. Snow level 5,000 feet rising to 7,500 feet after midnight. Temperature rising to 41 by 3 a.m. Southwest winds 10, gusts up to 20. New rain between a quarter and a half inch possible. And on Wednesday, 50% chance of rain, cloudy, gradually becoming mostly sunny, high 48. South winds 15, gusts up to 30, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. Currently 34 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. And if you get the KRFP winter fundraising letter in the mail, be sure to donate to your community radio station, which is helping keep community alive and building community in the Moscow area. That's what community radio does. Thanks for listening. Thanks for donating. Flashpoints is up next.